start actually by introducing our panel here. So let's see. Let's start with Ritu. You guys just heard him, but just say hi, where your name and where you're from.
Hi, I'm Ritu Sani. I'm from Portland, Oregon. Originally from Michigan, go blue.
Oh boy.
There you go.
Yeah, you know that guy already.
Yeah, I got a mic.
You know Tyler too. But
go ahead, do your... originally from Oregon and currently and rest of my life as far as it's planned now in Kentucky. Very happy here.
Go Ducks.
Go Ducks.
Hey guys, I'm Tyler from the Foam Frat podcast, and I help Eric out with some of the Flight Bridge Edge stuff. And I work as a flight paramedic at LifeLink 3 out of Minneapolis.
Thank you, Tyler.
Hey, everybody. Faizan Arshad, born and raised in the boogie down Bronx, New York. Coming at you guys real hot. I'm an emergency physician with fellowship training in point-of-care ultrasonography, as well as, of course, EMS and disaster preparedness. Privilege and a pleasure to be with all of you here today.
And Dan Davis, I'm in San Diego, but I tend to be most affiliated with Air Methods, which is in Colorado. And then do ground medical direction for Riverside County.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. So a little correction on the thing. So they got two mics. Eric's got one on his neck up there, and I've got this one here. That leaves us with no mic. So if you want to ask a question, please raise your hand. Let's start with the first one. And this just goes to whoever wants to take a stab. And it is, why hasn't TXA become more widely accepted and put into practice across the United States? So we tend to see it more in the HEMS environment, but the data clearly shows that the earlier the better. If you wait too long, it's actually harmful. So whoever wants to take a stab at that, and feel free again to pass the microphones.
I see what you did there. Stab.
Yes.
I'll be here all week. Well, as it would turn out, till Thursday morning.
Yeah. It's interesting because trauma seems to follow a different set of rules. We tend to be in a more of a mother may I mode, and the trauma community itself hasn't glommed onto TXA. And part of it is frustrating because I feel like most things that are at an advanced level, they would like to maintain control of, and that, you know, extends out to chest tubes and early intubation and all of that, and it smacks of that to me, that there's that aspect to it, and that they have dug in their heels, and because they tend to have control over most of the EMS activity.
When he's talking about they, he's referring to trauma surgeons, in case anybody didn't know that.
Yeah, we know about those guys. Raise your hand if you're a trauma surgeon. No, okay.
But there's certainly a lot of other things that we do that have much less evidence that are already in clinical practice.
So TXA is something that's very near and dear to my heart. Thank you so much for that question. I think it's a brilliant question. I just want to plug my tweeting maniac friend. He's a ginger in the back, not standing next to Ginger Locks. Clint, he's going to be talking all about TXA tomorrow, so definitely hang on, stand by.
It's today.
This afternoon, he's coming in extra hot, caliente. TXA, so we started getting excited about TXA in what decade? Late 60s, early 70s. So TXA has been around for a long, long time. And guess what? It's cheap. And that means it's not expensive. Pharma is not actively pushing this medication. We started getting really excited about this with the military efforts overseas in the recent wars, and we found that young, healthy adult males who were injured and had potential injuries where they were hemorrhaging, extravasating, internal bleeding, etc., benefited significantly from TXA. Now, there are certainly some generalizability issues or concerns to that patient population when you come and talk about our domestic population, but nevertheless, there is an institutional and a cultural challenge to getting local trauma centers to onboard TXA, so much so that when I was running EMS operations in like New Jersey, a large part of it, we made the decision.
What exit were you?
What exit? Like 14 through like Yeah, exactly. So we made the decision, you know, part of the trauma centers did not want to onboard. Like, no, we don't really feel like giving TXA. So the concern is one gram is given in the EMS transport over 10 minutes, and the second gram is given over the next 8 hours. But trauma hospitals were not inclined to give that. And as Mike very eloquently mentioned, the earlier you give it, the greater the opportunity for you to potentially change outcomes. So we said, F it. We're going to start carrying it on our trucks and our buses because this has the potential to save patient lives. We have now great outcomes data that shows it doesn't increase your DVT risk. It doesn't increase your PE risk. Sure, you may find an extra DVT, et cetera, along the way, but it's because you're surviving. So tons of randomized prospective literature is underway on this in Europe, and we are going to get great outcomes data, and hopefully it will start to become more common stream. But this is one of those situations where we as EMAC practitioners need to advocate and push for our patients.
Absolutely, great. So I'm going to move on real quick. Did someone have a quick comment? Ritu, did you want to follow up? All right. So
I never have a quick one. So
I know. That's why I was hoping you said no. Anyway, so one of our friends on Twitter, and get this, listen to this, @ILoveKetamine, right? So who doesn't? This is, I guess, the question. But it's my good buddy Jason Jensen from Portland, Oregon. And he's got a question for you about maintaining diplomacy in a transfer situation. So I'm going to hand the mic over.
All right. Thanks, Mike. I did actually ask how did Ritu get so cool, but we can just forgo that one. That's fine.
It's not repeatable.
Right, you know. So how do we as critical care providers navigate the diplomacy of dealing with... Hello, hot mic. Critical care providers navigate the diplomacy of dealing with rural hospitals or EMS providers that just want the patient out there. When we need to stay and play versus load and go.
All right, I'll start off with that.
Go ahead, Tyler.
Because I think this is good, because we have a physicians on the stage, and then we have EMS as well. So we've all seen that situation, right? We come walking in, all right, just get them out. We got to go get them out of here as soon as possible. And there are some circumstances where we can absolutely stand by that, right? You got a STEMI patient. You got a patient with a stroke going for basket retrieval. We need to get them out as soon as possible. But when I worked at LifeStar, we used to do these critical care rounding sessions, and we would ask the providers, you know, so what do you see and what's going on, what could we improve on, and everybody would take a topic. This got brought up all the time. We're barely able to get a phase sheet, any information before they're pushing us out the door. And we cannot control the hospital side of the equation. They've been with this patient for who knows how long. They're trying to resuscitate them, and they don't understand the confined space that we work with in a helicopter, the logistics and austere environment of bouncing down the road in an ambulance trying to stabilize them. So I believe there are situations where absolutely, they're calling us to get them to a cath lab. We're not going to fix them right there. It doesn't make sense for us to bust out ultrasound right there at the bed, or, all right, we need to do that. We can start that second IV while we're flying. I 100% agree with that. But if you're going in and you have a patient that is in the ICU, or you have a patient that has a lot of drips or on a ventilator, those patients cannot be rushed. We have to take the time to make sure we're getting the dosing, we're switching everything over. The ventilator requirements that they're on, if they're important, we're switching that over. And I think one of the things that we found was getting sometimes the staff involved. So if you decide, all right, I got to RSI this patient before we leave. I don't want to intubate. And you know, like in some of the helicopters, our setup is we have two people sitting here, the patient's here to intubate. You have to do like a Ducanto, you know, tomahawk maneuver to get the tube in. And so we'll RSI right there. But what we do, and I think is phenomenal at LifeLink 3, is we will hand them an intubation checklist, and we involve them in that. And we instead of them going, what are they doing in there? They've been in there for 20 minutes. We hand them this checklist. We go, hey, can you guys read this off? And we involve them in that intubation. And by involving them in the care, them seeing that we're not just diddle-daddling around, but we're making progressive movements, we're having that conversation with the doctor, I feel like it's put us all on the same team, and it hasn't really turned into a us versus them, hurry up and get out of there as soon as you can. So that's what I found has helped, is just involving the staff, and then also having these conversations before the calls even happen. Go into your local EDs, do ventilator management training with them, teach them what you're doing. They would be amazed to see the amount of ventilator knowledge that paramedics and nurses have. I think they think everybody just goes on a rate of, you know, 12 and a tidal volume of 500. We are so far above that. So I'd be interested to hear what you think from a... 460. What's that?
460.
Yeah. 460. 460, I'm sorry. Rate of PIPA 12, 5, FiO2 PIPA 100. 5.
Yeah, yeah, you got it.
Just about I had a freaking seizure.
The Flight Bridge Ed Air and Surface Transport Symposium Series changed the rules for EMS conferences.
Fast 21 Virtual will be no different.
This year's program will take place May 11th and 12th, 2021. And while we all can't get together, believe me when I tell you, we are working hard to make it feel like you are there. Go to fastsymposium.com for more information and to get your Fast Pass now.
Go ahead. So I just to add to that, I think Tyler hit most of that stuff very, very well. I think from my experience, I really, you know, reflecting back, I haven't had a big problem seeing hospitals, you know, be pushy like that. Yes, there's those circumstances. I think it comes down to, as he said, relationships. Coming down to communication and going, you know, if you're in an aircraft that's in a certain specific area, you're probably going to be going to those same hospitals. Yeah, you may hit outlying hospitals, but you're going to build relationships. And that's where you have meetings, have your medical base supervisor, meet with the ER director. Get this stuff out in the open. Explain, hey, this is why we may be 20, 30 minutes, 40 minutes on a certain type of call. Or in contrast, hey, if it's a STEMI, we're probably going to clamp off the heparin. We might even just clamp off the nitro for a second. We may not even shut down.
Oh, God forbid you clamp off the heparin, man.
Oh, but yeah. But so if you
shouldn't
address
just throw
that
it
stuff,
at them.
Absolutely.
Turn off the nitro and just
sprinkle them.
Because that doesn't impact outcome, yeah. Right?
Lots of research on that.
But I think it comes down to communication. You know, and I think it comes down to building those relationships. And I think once you bridge that gap, I think a lot of the stuff can be mitigated.
Awesome. Dr. Sani, did you want to add?
Yeah, I did. So it's I've been on both ends. I've been a flight doc flying in, having to stabilize the 5-year-old kid whose airway needed work and had to have a long conversation with the family before we intubated the child. And I've been the doc at a rural hospital going, what the hell? It's only like a 5-minute flight. Why are they, you know? So I've been on both ends. I think the proper answer is the same answer for lots of things in what we do. Empathy. You have to have empathy for the patient. You have to have empathy for the family. You have to have empathy for your teammates that are taking care of this patient. So if this is a critically ill, unstable patient that they've been working on for an hour, or 2 hours, or 4 hours, and you walk in with your crispy flight suit and yada, yada, you can't be the pro from Dover.
Crispy flight suit?
Yeah, whatever. Mine was always pressed before I went in. So
crispy.
If you've got hair like this, but you can't just show up
and an extra medium
show
shirt
up with your golf bag and say we're the pros from Dover. Nobody even knows what that's from anymore. So you have to go in with empathy and be humble, and you're here to help. We're here to help you take care of this patient, and let's just do this together. I've always found that worked out really well.
The first thing I like to ask when I either jump in the back of an ambulance on a flight scene call or, you know, go into the hospital, hey, what can I do to help? What do you guys need help with? And then now that you're involved, right? It's not, hey, all right, we're going to do this. You walk in, you say, hey, what can I do to help? The doc might say, hey, we're still trying to get an IV. Can you throw an IV in? And now we're on the same team with it. So that's just one line that completely reframes the way they approach it.
The one other,
practical piece.
Good, good stuff.
The piece is that where I used to fly out of, our dispatch center was always, when we went for an interfacility ICU in particular, our dispatch center would always say, you can plan on them being on the ground for about 30 to 45 minutes because it's not a complicated patient.
Yeah, that's perfect.
So they created that expectation. And then when you got out, you know, when you Mr. Scotted them and got out in 20 minutes and had the Enterprise flying beautifully in 15, then you beat expectations.
And when that hospital is requesting medevac or a helicopter EMS transport, you know, what are the underlying emotions of that team? And by definition, they have a critically ill patient that they cannot manage, right? So it's going to be fear and insecurity. So just to sort of plant the seeds for tomorrow, I'm going to be talking about training your limbic system, both recognizing fear and insecurity and anxiety in yourself, but also recognizing it in other folks and learning how to systematically sort of de-trigger or step them off the ledge and incorporate them via clear, concise communication to be a part of your team so they're adding value, not necessarily being a hindrance. And at the end of the day, if the doctor is a dick, you can also just say, hey doc, you know by EMTALA, you carry the liability for this patient until we reach the destination hospital.
So you're slapping the card down, the EMTALA card down.
Yeah.
By the way, did anyone notice my limbic system was like going like really fast because I'm like doing all this stuff back here. So, but anyway, no good. Do you have one closing thought? No. All right. One more question. We got about 6 minutes, so we're doing good. I'm trying to avoid the speakers here. All right. How do you see the process of fluid resuscitation evolving both pre-hospital and in-hospital? And this is a question from Facebook. When I went through paramedic school in 2004, 2005, pretty much everyone, regardless of how severely you're injured or ill somebody was, they got a couple liters of saline, normal saline. But thankfully that has gone away. What are your thoughts on like 500 mil bowls and how often to reassess and all that kind of stuff? So who wants to take a little hit on that one? Earth to the panel. Earth to the panel. I know there's a lot to take in. But we know there was just a study that was just released a couple weeks ago, right, that was looking at all that. So maybe you could speak to something like that.
I mean, I'll jump in, and I know this is one of those topics that Dan loves to talk about, right?
Yeah. Reminder, 6 minutes is what we got.
Yeah, so I think we have to, number one, where I see the problem is when we get into the rural environments. And you know, we all teach it this concept, and we'll talk about normal saline, we'll talk about LR. Talk about specific types of patients, and I get, well, we don't even carry LR. Well, why not? Well, I don't know. That's the answer. I don't know. Maybe it costs too much. I don't know.
It don't cost too much.
I think the key thing is that we have to get out of the mindset of that's how we used to do it. I think we need to give fluid definitively. There's lots of ways, whether we're in sepsis, and I, you know, Ashley, my wife, and I talk about this oftentimes. Sepsis, they use the 30 mils per kilo. But are we using ideal body weight? And I don't think we are. I think we look at somebody's weight and we give them 30 mils per kilo. If I weighed 400 pounds, that would be 6 liters of fluid. So I think we have to be definitive. And so I think you give fluid if you need to give fluid, right? Do we have a perfusing map of 65? And then look at your overall presentation.
I'm so glad you brought up MAP. That's a huge thing that often gets overlooked, right? Dr. David, I see two people are at the ready. Don't matter. Go ahead.
Yeah, so what is the pH of normal saline? Everybody got once. 6.5, that's even being generous. It's like 5.4 to 5.5 with a SID of 0. So your SID is your strong ion difference. You take your sodium and your chloride and you look at what the difference is. It's very acidic, and it can cause a hyperchloremic acidosis. Are we going to cause that pre-hospital? You know, probably not. That's probably once they're in the ICU and they're getting multiple boluses of this fluid. But the thing to consider is, have you guys seen the SMART trial that just came out? The average fluid that was given was about 1,200 cc's. So there's this thought process that the field is some limbo, you know, realm. And nothing we do in the field really, you know, okay, that's fine. We gave them, nobody will die from a cup of coffee. That's what people used to say. You know, you can always give them a little bit of fluid. And I think we're starting to reevaluate that now. And I think that's really good. And if you have a patient that has a low MAP, they're not perfusing, that is a strong indicator of end organ damage and mortality eventually. And you give them a liter of fluid and they're not coming up. Another liter of fluid might not really help, right? That's not really how the Starling curve works. Once we keep giving them fluid, we're trying to optimize preload. Eventually, we're going to have to start a pressor. And so I think instead of saying, are they fluid responsive, we're going to start saying, all right, they got some fluid, now are they pressor responsive?
So just like in trauma, it took us a long time to figure out that giving blood products in a balanced fashion is better than not giving blood products at all. or giving RBCs only, in with exception to plasma, platelets, FFP, etc. So normal saline and crystalloid instead of resuscitating your patients is likely going to head in the same direction. We need to be balanced. Also, it just, I think of, if you keep doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different outcome, you're an idiot.
And you can quote that. Send that on Twitter, at... I'm just kidding.
I have to restart my phone like 8 times the same... No.
We got 2 minutes to go. Andy, 2 minutes to go, panel.
2 minutes to go.
Did you have something?
No.
The only other thing I want to add was that sepsis is kind of interesting because we've basically been federally mandated to give 30 milliliters per kilogram. And I'm going to talk a little bit about advocacy tomorrow because we have to always pitch our next upcoming talks as part of this. But this is a great example of policy driving bad care. I mean, there's the data continues to come out that the patients who get the full 30 milliliters per kilogram, which is probably a combination of not using ideal body weight and using what I prefer to call carnival weight.
There you go.
Step right up.
Yeah.
Guess your weight. Win a stuffed toy. That's what we do. We do carnival weights. And
Can you trade the smaller animals for the bigger ones, like at the carnival?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And
good.
The number of times that, like, there's a in the emergency department, I just hit this button on the bed, and a weight pops up. And they still, they're like, oh no, he told me he was 400 pounds, and we just put that in. I'm like, okay, that's great. So we're using non-ideal carnival weights. We're giving way too much fluid. There's new data out that shows that the patients who got the extreme ends of the fluids did poorly. The birth of early goal-directed therapy is a great example of what happens if you do a single study in a single institution, and then make it into apply that other places.
Great. Awesome. Well, guys, we are out of time. Hey, give a big hand to our critical care panel. Thank you guys so much. Appreciate that. Okay.